Yes, I'm Angel Rabassa. I'm a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, specializing in international security, and especially issues relating to terrorism and insurgency and political Islam. Before that, I was a member of the United States Foreign Service. I was a co-author of a book with Steve Larrabee, who I'm sure you're familiar yes. with, called The Rise of Political Islam in Turkey, mm-hmm. that has to do with the AKP, you know, coming to power and its policies. Mm-hmm. I have written publications about Somalia, about Southeast Asia. There is a book coming out on terrorism in Europe. So it's, you know, broad international security issues were also also more specifically relating to terrorism. Yes. And I have some, again, I have been involved with Turkey. So, I was in the State Department and I was a Turkish desk officer back in the 1980s. Well, I think that before we can offer a solution to the problem of terrorism in the Middle East, I mean, and not only in the Middle East, because you find terrorist attacks in Indonesia, in Africa, in Europe. So it's a global phenomenon. But I think that, you know, before we offer solutions, we need to understand what are the sources of this terrorism. Now, terrorism is itself a tactic. I mean, it's something that can be used by groups of very different ideological persuasions to try to obtain political outcomes. And of course, you know, you see groups like the Irish terrorists in the United Kingdom, there are Basque terrorists in France and Spain, there is a right-wing terrorist in Northern Europe, and they're violent, and that's what they have in common, but they come from very different ideological persuasions, and the terrorism is meant to advance a particular agenda. Now, when you speak of the type of terrorism that you see in the Middle East and other countries that's carried on by groups with an Islamist ideology, the terrorism that we see here is a manifestation of some very deep divides within the Muslim world. And I would like to point out that the majority of the victims of this particular terrorist, of this particular type of terrorist, are Muslims. Because sometimes we in the West see ourselves as the primary victims, but we are not. I mean, far more Muslims had been killed by radical right. Islamist terrorists than people of other religions. And so that's something that needs to be kept in mind, that it's a product. This terrorism is a product of a conflict, of an ideological conflict within certain Muslim countries. And this is a divide between, on the one hand, the vast majority of Muslims who are, you know, peace-abiding, who are, I don't like to use the word moderate, but say mainstream Muslims, people who practice their religion in a traditional way, have done this for centuries. And then you have a very small, by and large, a very small sector of the population who are motivated by radical ideologies. And their objective is to force their ideologies on the majority of people in Muslim majority countries. You see this group doing things, for example, or adherence to this particular ideology, like destroying religious shrines and monuments in places like Timbuktu. In Africa, we see that the radicals who have taken over the city of Timbuktu have been systematically destroying the religious and cultural heritage of one of the most important centers of Islamic learning in Africa. During the Bosnian War, they destroyed many monuments that had been created during the Ottoman period in Bosnia. In Somalia, they have made a practice of destroying the shrines of Sufi. Sufi holy men, so they you see you know this wave of violence is directed again not only against Westerners but also against the majority of Muslims themselves who do not partake of the ideology, and the violence is used as a mean against of attaining certain political objectives. So that is again the root of the terrorism as we see it has to do with this ideological divide within Muslim communities. So the solution, if you ask me, what can we do to end this type of terrorism? And again, I'm not speaking about all terrorism because they have different types of terrorism, have different ideological sources. But this is something that needs to be accomplished by the Muslims themselves. Non-Muslims, people in the United States and in Europe, can only play a supportive role. I mean, we can help, we can provide assistance, we can provide support, but it's a mainstream Muslims themselves, you know, who need to deal with what is basically an attack on their own culture and on their own traditions and on their own practices of their religion. Let me point something that's very interesting about what's generally called Salafism, because you know most of the terrorists with an Islamist ideology they're a violent type of Salafis. This is actually a modern ideology, because even though they claim that they go back to the practices of the time of the Prophet Muhammad and the ancestors, this is the Salaf, where Salaf, of course, that is to say that the practices of the 7th and 8th centuries of a common era, 1st and 2nd centuries of Islam, in reality, their ideology is quite modern and is based on Western ideologies, that totalitarian ideologies that developed in the 20th centuries. And one of, you know, of the interesting aspects of this phenomenon, as even though it claims to go back to very early, a very early period of Islam, the whole totalitarian conception that they have is quite modern, as well as the methods that they use to disseminate their ideology. Yeah. You know, you're quite right that if you look at the Arab world in particular, and the Arab world has been, of course, the focus of this terrorism. If you look at the Arab world, the type of ideologies and governments that that came to power after independence from the colonial powers, they generally had Marxist or socialist ideologies. So they Nasser himself was a perfectly good example of that. So that the prevailing ideology among the political elites and the revolutionaries in the Arab world in those days was Marxism or socialism. And what happened is that these ideologies failed to produce political and economic development for the Arab countries. So what happened is that the failure of this particular political and economic model opened the way for religious radicalism. Because when the socialist and Marxist models failed, then the adherents of radical Islamism could argue that they were the solution. And in fact, the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is Islam is the solution. What they mean by Islam is their particular interpretation of Islam. So you're quite right that the failure of these political and economic models is what opened the door to radical Islamist solutions to the challenges and the problems of political and economic and social development in Arab countries in particular, and also in other Muslim countries, not necessarily Arab. Now, what's happening now is very interesting, and this is where I think Turkey, could actually play a very important role as a model, because what we have seen in the so-called Arab Spring, and of course we don't know how the where this movement is going to end. It could end well or it could end badly. But one of the characteristics of the revolts against authoritarian governments in places like Egypt and Tunisia and Libya is that the people who revolted against these governments were not doing it on the basis of an Islamist agenda. They were not trying to establish, you know, Sharia law, or they were looking for democracy, and they were looking for governments that were responsive to the interest of the people. And even if you look at the slogans of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, you don't see a lot of emphasis on the religious aspect of the Brotherhood's agenda. What you saw is an emphasis on democracy, on popular representation. So if the this political revolution in the Arab world, if it is successful, and it is successful in bringing about a degree of democratic and responsive governance to countries that have never experienced democracy, have always been under authoritarian rule of one form or another. But if they can do that, if they can produce governments that are responsive to the people, then what they are doing is they're taking away much of the justification for radical Islamists who argued that the only way to bring about this type of change is through violence. So this could take, as we say, the wind off the sails of radical Islamism if they can bring government that's more responsive to the people. There is a downside to that, on the other hand, that because revolution and what has happened in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and is happening in Syria is, of course, revolution, there is always a period of turmoil, of chaos, that can be instrumentalized by radicals. I mean, they may be small, they may not have popular support, but because government is weak and the police is disorganized and the security service have disappeared, they can do things. And I think this is the explanation for this terrible incident in Libya. From what I know, the majority of the Libyan people, of the people in Benghazi, is a city that was saved from destruction, you know, by the Western coalition, including Turkey, that prevented Gaddafi from moving into the city. There is actually a great deal of sympathy and support for, you know, countries like the United States, like France, like Turkey. But this did not prevent a very small group of armed militants from assaulting the consulate and, of course, assassinating the ambassador and other persons. These obviously are people who did not represent the views of the Libyan people because of a lack of authority, because the government was not organized enough to maintain law and order and to prevent this type of attack. They were able to do that. So in this period of transition from authoritarianism to stable democracy, there is always a great danger that militant groups, that, you know, violent radicals, you know, could take advantage of this power vacuum to insert themselves and to cause problems. Well, I mean, there are some limits to what Turkey can do, as to what we have seen in the case of Syria. But I think that Turkey is playing and can play a very constructive role in bringing about, you know, better understanding about people of, you know, different nationalities and religions. And I think Turkey itself, I mean, Turkey has this very long tradition of tolerance. That everyone knows. I mean, Turkey is the country that, even before it was Turkey, when it was, of course, the Ottoman Empire, that welcomed the Spanish Jews that had been expelled from Spain in, you know, 1492. It is a country that maintained at the time when the norm in Western Europe was religious persecution, where it maintained multiplicity of different religions, religious and national groups. So history. So Turkey has a very strong history of tolerance. You know, that I think can be very helpful, and also in the practice of religion in Turkey has always been, you know, very, very tolerant. You know, when we wrote the book, The Rise of Political Islam in Turkey, we quoted polls that show that while, you know, the majority of Turkey were, you know, practicing Muslims, that in fact they exhibited high levels of tolerance for individuals, people from other religions.
That
has been seen in day-to-day practice, in daily practice in Turkey, in the polls. At the same time, I think was most important about Turkey, and was, you know, I think very, very significant in terms of the model that Turkey can present to other countries in the Middle East, is the fact that in Turkey we can see an example of the compatibility of Islam and democracy, because the case has been made. By, you know, by some scholars and polemicists, that the reason for the lack of democracy in the Middle East is Islam. That somehow you need to have a particular religious heritage to have a successful democracy, and that there are elements within the Islamic faith that are not consistent with democracy. But what countries like Turkey and also like Indonesia and Malaysia, for example, have shown is that yes, it is possible, and in fact it's done, to have countries that are Muslim majority. I mean, it's a 99% Muslim in the case of Turkey, and at the same time have a democratic government. So I think that the most important the thing that Turkey can do with regard to the development of democratic development in the Middle East is its example, to show that yes, you can have a government by a party that has, you know, religious roots, and it's governed by individuals who are devout Muslims, and at the same time, this is not in any way incompatible with having a democratic political system. So I think that the example of Turkey could be very important to encourage people in other Middle Eastern countries that are undergoing this process of political change to believe that, yes, it is possible to have their religion and also to have a democratic political system. And Turkey is playing a very important role. Now it's, I mean, it's a unique country in that it's is Muslim majority, but it's also a secular democracy.
Yes,
it's part of NATO. It's, you know, the only
ally of the United States.
Yeah, that's right. A country in NATO. But it's also, you know, historically part of the Middle East.
Yeah.
It's also part of, I mean, has affinities to Central Asia for,
right,
you know, historical reasons. And, you know, in many Central Asian countries, they speak languages that have affinities with Turkish.
Right.
It has, you know, long-standing relations with Russia, with the Balkans.
Right.
So it's quite, you know, a multi-dimensional country, so it makes it very important for the United States, you know, from sort of our own international perspective. There used to be a time, if you go back to the history of the United States in the 19th century, you know, say around the middle of the 19th century, when the United States at the time had a very large immigration of people of Irish and Italian and from people from Catholic countries. We had millions of Irish, Italians, and other Catholics coming to the United States in the 19th century. And at the time, there were individuals who argued that the Catholic religion was not compatible with American-style democracy. And they said, look at Europe, look at Spain, these countries are not democratic. So the same argument that was made about Islam today was made about
Catholicism back in the 19th century. Of course, today there is no incompatibility. And Catholic countries in Europe are all democratic. So the same, I think, is true of Islam. That is a false argument that is made that the particular religion is not compatible with a democratic political system. That it has to do really with culture and with the willingness of people, to accept the values of democracy. And your other question is about tolerance. And tolerance is, again, it's one of the values that we consider to be important. I mentioned that earlier that, I'm not sure that I want to use the term moderate with regard to, Muslims, say moderate Muslims, because it implies that less strong in their support of the religion that they would otherwise, and that is not the case. But the type of, I think, of mainstream Islam that, again, that's opposed to this or that's been under attack by these the radical sectors has certain characteristics. And one of the characteristics, in which that I would ascribe to the type of Islam, that I think, should be defended, is respect for the rights of women and religious minorities. And I think we see that in Turkey. So that's whereas we see those rights being suppressed in places where, radical Islamists are in power, in places like Iran, for example, in other countries as well, where, women are not given the same rights that they have in countries like Turkey. And when apostasy, it's a crime. One problem that I think that we find in analyzing these issues, especially with regard to the treatment of women, is that sometimes we confuse religion with culture. And as you say, Islam is perfectly compatible, with respect for the rights of women and religious minorities. But sometimes local cultures are not hospitable to this type of equality. And I think the problem that we see in some countries, in some places, is that people confuse what's kind of a cultural norm, which might not be a very good cultural norm from our perspective, with a religious obligation. And they think that depriving women, for example, of certain rights is a religious obligation, but it's not. It's really something that's more culturally based. Than,
it's a bigotry, actually.
Yes. Yes. So that's a problem, that sometimes people confuse their own culture with their religion.
Yes.
And
definitely right, yes.
And it's very bad, I mean, if I could make a value judgment, when people, especially in certain countries, not only confuse their own culture with their religion, with Islam in this case, but they think that their culture should be forced upon other people. Yeah. And we see, for example, one good case of that, I think, is in the case of Bosnia, because I spent time in Bosnia during the Bosnian War, and in my State Department position, trying to support the Bosnian Federation. And what we found is that individuals in Bosnia who were very influenced by the Saudis would desecrate these beautiful mosques that had been built under the Ottomans, and they would get rid of all of the decorations and would paint them white, because according to them, this wasn't properly acceptable. Of course, they were wrong. They were conveying their own cultural ideas. Just because things were such in Saudi Arabia doesn't mean that they had to be such everywhere else. And this goes back to the point that I made before, that to the extent that the sources of terrorism reside in a radical interpretation of the Quran, it's not something that non-Muslims can deal with. I mean, because we have no authority to tell Muslims or, you know, how to interpret the Quran. I mean, if I were to come and tell you or have a debate with, say, a radical, and we say, well, you're misinterpreting the Quran, what authority do I have? It has to be done by Muslim scholars themselves. Because what happens here is that the radicals, they have their own scholars, and they select their own interpretations of verses in the Quran to support their position. And the difference, from an analytical perspective, the difference between the way in which mainstream Muslims, the majority of Muslims, interpret the Quran and the way in which radicals do it, is that mainstream Muslims look at all of the Quran and all of the tradition, whereas radicals would look at only a very few verses that support their position, and they would ignore the rest. So you have a very biased interpretation. But in order to show to people who may not know the difference why their interpretation is wrong, then mainstream scholars, you know, need to come forward and need to explain why the radical interpretation is wrong. This is why at the bottom, this boils down to an ideological conflict. Mm-hmm. In other words, whose ideology is going to prevail? The ideology of the radicals, or the ideology that has been, you know, the way, not the ideology, but because it's not an ideology, but the way in which Islam has been traditionally interpreted for hundreds of years.